Early tradition attributes the building of Stonehenge to the power of Merlin. It was believed that those mighty stones were whirled through the air at his command from Ireland to Salisbury Plain, and that he arranged them in the form in which they now stand to commemorate forever the unhappy fate of 300 British chiefs who were massacred on that spot by the Saxons. At Abergwilly, near Carmarthen, is still shown the cave of the prophet and the scene of his incantations. How beautiful is the description of it given by Spenser in his Faery Queen. The lines need no apology for their repetition here, and any sketch of the great prophet of Britain would be incomplete without them. There the wise Merlin whilom wont, they say, to make his one low underneath the ground, in a deep delve far from the view of day, that of no living wight he mote be found. When so he counseled with his sprites and compassed round. And if thou ever happen that same way to travel, go to see that dreadful place. It is a hideous hollow cave, they say, under a rock that lies a little space from the swift berry, tumbling down apace amongst the woody hills of Dinevor. But dare thou not, I charge in any case, to enter into that same baleful bower, for fear the cruel fiends should thee unawares devour. But, standing high aloft, blow lay thine ear, and there such ghastly noise of iron chains and brazen cauldrons thou shalt rumbling hear, which thousand sprites with long-enduring pains do toss, that it will stun thy feeble brains. And oftentimes great groans and grievous stounds, when too huge toil and labor them constrains, and oftentimes loud strokes and ringing sounds from under that deep rock most horribly rebounds. The cause, they say, is this. A little while before that Merlin died, he did intend a brazen wall in compass to compile about Caer Murden, and did it commend unto these sprites to bring to perfect end. During which work the Lady of the Lake, whom long he loved, for him in haste did send, who thereby forced his workmen to forsake, them bound till his return their labor not to slake. In the meantime, through that false lady's train, he was surprised and buried under bier, ne ever to his work returned again. Natheless, these fiends may not their work forbear, so greatly his commandment they fear. But there do toil and travail day and night, until that brazen wall they up do rear. Amongst other English prophets, a belief in whose power has not been entirely effaced by the light of advancing knowledge, is Robert Nixon, the Cheshire Idiot, a contemporary of Mother Shipton. The popular accounts of this man say that he was born of poor parents, not far from Vale Royal, on the edge of the Forest of Delamere. He was brought up to the plough, but was so ignorant and stupid that nothing could be made of him. Everybody thought him irretrievably insane and paid no attention to the strange, unconnected discourses which he held. Many of his prophecies are believed to have been lost in this manner, but they were not always destined to be wasted upon dull and inattentive ears. An incident occurred which brought him into notice and established his fame as a prophet of the first caliber. He was ploughing in a field when he suddenly stopped from his labor, and with a wild look and strange gesture exclaimed, "Now, Dick, now, Harry! Oh, ill done, Dick! Oh, well done, Harry! Harry has gained the day!" His fellow laborers in the field did not know what to make of this rhapsody, but the next day cleared up the mystery. News was brought by a messenger in hot haste that at the very instant when Nixon had thus ejaculated, Richard III had been slain at the Battle of Bosworth, and Henry VII proclaimed King of England. It was not long before the fame of the new prophet reached the ears of the king, who expressed a wish to see and converse with him. A messenger was accordingly dispatched to bring him to court, but long before he reached Cheshire, Nixon knew and dreaded the honors that awaited him. Indeed, it was said that at the very instant the king expressed the wish, Nixon was, by supernatural means, made acquainted with it, and that he ran about the town of Over in great distress of mind, calling out like a madman that Henry had sent for him, and that he must go to court and be clammed, that is, starved to death. These expressions excited no little wonder, but on the third day the messenger arrived and carried him to court, leaving on the minds of the good people of Cheshire an impression that their prophet was one of the greatest ever born. On his arrival, King Henry appeared to be troubled exceedingly at the loss of a valuable diamond, and asked Nixon if he could inform him where it was to be found. Henry had hidden the diamond himself with a view to test the prophet's skill. Great, therefore, was his surprise when Nixon answered him in the words of the old proverb, "Those who hide can find." From that time forth, the king implicitly believed that he had the gift of prophecy, and ordered all his words to be taken down. During all the time of his residence at court, he was in constant fear of being starved to death, and repeatedly told the king that such would be his fate if he were not allowed to depart and return into his own country. Henry would not suffer it, but gave strict orders to all his officers and cooks to give him as much to eat as he wanted. He lived so well that for some time he seemed to be thriving like a nobleman's steward and growing as fat as an alderman. One day the king went out hunting when Nixon ran to the palace gate and entreated on his knees that he might not be left behind to be starved. The king laughed and, calling an officer, told him to take especial care of the prophet during his absence, and rode away to the forest. After his departure, the servants of the palace began to jeer at and insult Nixon, whom they imagined to be much better treated than he deserved. Nixon complained to the officer, who, to prevent him from being further molested, locked him up in the king's own closet and brought him regularly his four meals a day. But it so happened that a messenger arrived from the king to this officer requiring his immediate presence at Winchester on a matter of life and death. So great was his haste to obey the king's command that he mounted on the horse behind the messenger and rode off, without bestowing a thought upon poor Nixon. He did not return till 3 days afterwards, when, remembering the prophet for the first time, he went to the king's closet and found him lying upon the floor, starved to death as he had predicted. Among the prophecies of his which are believed to have been fulfilled are the following, which relate to the times of the pretender. A great man shall come into England, but the son of a king shall take from him the victory. Crows shall drink the blood of many nobles, and the north shall rise against the south. The cock of the north shall be made to flee, and his feather be plucked for his pride, that he shall almost curse the day that he was born. All these, say his admirers, are as clear as the sun at noonday. The first denotes the defeat of Prince Charles Edward at the Battle of Culloden by the Duke of Cumberland. The second, the execution of Lords Derwentwater, Balmerino, and Lovat. And the third, the retreat of the pretender from the shores of Britain. Among the prophecies that still remain to be accomplished are the following. Between 7, 8, and 9, in England wonders shall be seen. Between 9 and 13, all sorrow shall be done. Through our own money and our men shall a dreadful war begin. Between the sickle and the suck, all England shall have a pluck. Foreign nations shall invade England with snow on their helmets, and shall bring plague, famine, and murder in the skirts of their garments. The town of Nantwich shall be swept away by a flood. Of the two first of these, no explanation has yet been attempted, but some event or other will doubtless be twisted into such a shape as will fit them. The third, relative to the invasion of England by a nation with snow on their helmets, is supposed by the old women to foretell most clearly a coming war with Russia. As to the last, there are not a few in the town mentioned who devoutly believe that such will be its fate. Happily for their peace of mind, the prophet said nothing of the year that was to witness the awful calamity, so that they think it is likely to be 2 centuries hence, as now. The popular biographers of Nixon conclude their account of him by saying that his prophecies are by some persons thought fables, yet by what has come to pass it is now thought, and very plainly appears, that most of them have proved or will prove true, for which we on all occasions ought not only to exert our utmost might to repel by force our enemies, but to refrain from our abandoned and wicked course of life, and to make our continual prayer to God for protection and safety. To this, through a non sequitur, everyone will cry Amen. Besides the prophets, there have been the almanac makers, Lilly, Poor Robin, Partridge, and Francis Moore, physician in England, and Matthew Landsberg in France and Belgium. But great as were their pretensions, they were modesty itself in comparison with Merlin, Shipton, and Nixon, who fixed their minds upon higher things than the weather, and were not so restrained as to prophesy for only 1 year at a time. After such prophets, the almanac makers hardly deserved to be mentioned. Not even the renowned Partridge, whose prognostications set all England agog in 1708, and whose death, while still alive, was so pleasantly and satisfactorily proved by Isaac Bickerstaff. The anticlimax would be too palpable, and they and their doings must be left uncommemorated. Fortune-telling. And men still grope t'anticipate the cabinet designs of fate, apply to wizards to foresee what shall and what shall never be. Hudibras, Part 3, Canto 3. In accordance with the plan laid down, we proceed to the consideration of the follies into which men have been led by their eager desire to pierce the thick darkness of futurity. God himself, for his own wise purposes, has more than once undrawn the impenetrable veil which shrouds those awful secrets, and for purposes just as wise he has decreed that, except in these instances, ignorance shall be our lot forever. It is happy for man that he does not know what the morrow is to bring forth, but unaware of this great blessing, he has, in all ages of the world, presumptuously endeavored to trace the events of unborn centuries, and anticipate the march of time. He has reduced this presumption into a study. He has divided it into sciences and systems without number, employing his whole life in the vain pursuit. Upon no subject has it been so easy to deceive the world as upon this. In every breast the curiosity exists in a greater or less degree, and can only be conquered by a long course of self-examination, and a firm reliance that the future would not be hidden from our sight if it were right that we should be acquainted with it. An undue opinion of our own importance in the scale of creation is at the bottom of all our unwarrantable notions in this respect. How flattering to the pride of man to think that the stars in their courses watch over him, and typify by their movements and aspects the joys or the sorrows that await him. He, less in proportion to the universe than the all but invisible insects that feed on myriads on a summer's leaf are to this great globe itself, fondly imagines that eternal worlds were chiefly created to prognosticate his fate. How we should pity the arrogance of the worm that crawls at our feet if we knew that it also desired to know the secrets of futurity, and imagined that meteors shot athwart the sky to warn it that a tomtit was hovering near to gobble it up, that storms and earthquakes, the revolutions of empires, or the fall of mighty monarchs only happened to predict its birth, its progress, and its decay. Not a whit less presuming has man shown himself, not a whit less arrogant are the sciences, so-called, of astrology, augury, necromancy, geomancy, palmistry, and divination of every kind. Leaving out of view the oracles of pagan antiquity and religious predictions in general, and confining ourselves solely to the persons who, in modern times, have made themselves most conspicuous in foretelling the future, we shall find that the 16th and 17th centuries were the golden age of these impostors. Many of them have been already mentioned in their character of alchemists. The union of the two pretensions is not at all surprising. It was to be expected that those who assumed a power so preposterous as that of prolonging the life of man for several centuries should pretend at the same time to foretell the events which were to mark that preternatural span of existence. The world would as readily believe that they had discovered all secrets as that they had only discovered one. The most celebrated astrologers of Europe, 3 centuries ago, were alchemists. Agrippa, Paracelsus, Dr. Dee, and the Rosicrucians all laid as much stress upon their knowledge of the days to come as upon their pretended possession of the philosopher's stone and the elixir of life. In their time, ideas of the wonderful, the diabolical, and the supernatural were rifer than ever they were before. The devil or the stars were universally believed to meddle constantly in the affairs of men, and both were to be consulted with proper ceremonies. Those who were of a melancholy and gloomy temperament betook themselves to necromancy and sorcery. Those more cheerful and aspiring devoted themselves to astrology. The latter science was encouraged by all the monarchs and governments of that age. In England, from the time of Elizabeth to that of William and Mary, judicial astrology was in high repute. During that period flourished Doctors Dee, Lamb, and Forman, with Lilly, Booker, Gadbury, Evans, and scores of nameless impostors in every considerable town and village in the country, who made it their business to cast nativities, aid in the recovery of stolen goods, prognosticate happy or unhappy marriages, predict whether journeys would be prosperous, and note lucky moments for the commencement of any enterprise, from the setting up of a cobbler's shop to the marching of an army. Men who, to use the words of Butler, did deal in destiny's dark counsel and sage opinion of the moon sell, to whom all people far and near on deep importance did repair, when brass and pewter pots did stray and linen slunk out of the way. In Lilly's Memoirs of His Life and Times, there are many notices of the inferior quacks who then abounded, and upon whom he pretended to look down with supreme contempt, not because they were astrologers, but because they debased that noble art by taking fees for the recovery of stolen property. From Butler's Hudibras and its curious notes, we may learn what immense numbers of these fellows lived upon the credulity of mankind in that age of witchcraft and diablerie. Even in our day, how great is the reputation enjoyed by the almanac makers, who assume the name of Francis Moore. But in the time of Charles I and the Commonwealth, the most learned, the most noble, and the most conspicuous characters did not hesitate to consult astrologers in the most open manner. Lilly, whom Butler has immortalized under the name of Sidrafel, relates that he proposed to write a work called An Introduction to Astrology, in which he would satisfy the whole kingdom of the lawfulness of that art. Many of the soldiers were for it, he says, and many of the independent party, and abundance of worthy men in the House of Commons, his assured friends, and able to take his part against the Presbyterians, who would have silenced his predictions if they could. He afterwards carried his plan into execution, and when his book was published, went with another astrologer named Booker to the headquarters of the Parliamentary Army at Windsor, where they were welcomed and feasted in the garden where General Fairfax lodged. They were afterwards introduced to the general, who received them very kindly and made allusion to some of their predictions. He hoped their art was lawful and agreeable to God's word, but he did not understand it himself. He did not doubt, however, that the two astrologers feared God, and therefore he had a good opinion of them. Lilly assured him that the art of astrology was quite consonant to the scriptures, and confidently predicted from his knowledge of the stars that the parliamentary army would overthrow all its enemies. In Oliver's Protectorate, this quack informs us that he wrote freely enough. He became an independent, and all the soldiery were his friends. When he went to Scotland, he saw a soldier standing in front of the army with a book of prophecies in his hand, exclaiming to the several companies as they passed by him, "Lo, hear what Lilly saith! You are in this month promised victory. Fight it out, brave boys, and then read that month's prediction." After the great fire of London, which Lilly said he had foretold, he was sent for by the committee of the House of Commons appointed to inquire into the causes of the calamity. In his Monarchy or No Monarchy, published in 1651, he had inserted an hieroglyphical plate representing on one side persons in winding sheets digging graves, and on the other a large city in flames. After the great fire, some sapient member of the legislature bethought him of Lilly's book, and having mentioned it in the House, it was agreed that the astrologer should be summoned. Lilly attended accordingly, when Sir Robert Brooke told him the reason of his summons, and called upon him to declare what he knew. This was a rare opportunity for the vainglorious Lily to vaunt his abilities, and he began a long speech in praise of himself and his pretended science. He said that after the execution of Charles I, he was extremely desirous to know what might from that time forth happen to the Parliament and to the nation in general. He therefore consulted the stars and satisfied himself. The result of his judgment he put into emblems and hieroglyphs, without any commentary, so that the true meaning might be concealed from the vulgar and made manifest only to the wise, imitating in this the example of many wise philosophers who had done the like. "Did you foresee the year of the fire?" said a member. "No," quoth Lily, "nor was I desirous. Of that I made no scrutiny." After some further parley, the House found they could make nothing of the astrologer, and dismissed him with great civility. One specimen of the explanation of a prophecy given by Lily and related by him with much complacency will be sufficient to show the sort of trash by which he imposed upon the million. "In the year 1588," says he, "there was a prophecy printed in Greek characters, exactly deciphering the long troubles of the English nation from 1641 to 1660. And it ended thus: "And after him shall come a dreadful dead man, and with him a royal G, of the best blood in the world, and he shall have the crown, and shall set England on the right way, and put out all heresies." The following is the explanation of this oracular absurdity. Monkery being extinguished above 80 or 90 years, and the Lord General's name being Monk, is the dead man. The royal G, or C, it is gamma in the Greek, intending C in the Latin, being the third letter in the alphabet, is Charles II, who, for his extraction, may be said to be of the best blood of the world. In France and Germany, astrologers met even more encouragement than they received in England. In very early ages, Charlemagne and his successors fulminated their wrath against them in common with sorcerers. Louis XI, that most superstitious of men, entertained great numbers of them at his court, and Catherine de Médicis, that most superstitious of women, hardly ever undertook any affair of importance without consulting them. She chiefly favored her own countrymen, and during the time she governed France, the land was overrun by Italian conjurers, necromancers, and fortune-tellers of every kind. But the chief astrologer of that day, beyond all doubt, was the celebrated Nostradamus, physician to her husband, King Henry II. He was born in 1503 at the town of Saint-Remy in Provence, where his father was a notary. He did not acquire much fame till he was past his 50th year, when his famous Centuries, a collection of verses written in obscure and almost unintelligible language, began to excite attention. They were so much spoken of in 1556 that Henry II resolved to attach so skillful a man to his service, and appointed him his physician. In a biographical notice of him prefixed to the edition of his Vraie Centurie, published at Amsterdam in 1668, we are informed that he often discoursed with his royal master on the secrets of futurity, and received many great presents as his reward, besides his usual allowance for medical attendance. After the death of Henry, he retired to his native place, where Charles IX paid him a visit in 1564, and was so impressed with veneration for his wondrous knowledge of the things that were to be, not in France only, but in the whole world for hundreds of years to come, that he made him a counselor of state and his own physician, besides treating him in other matters with a royal liberality. "In fine," continues his biographer, "I should be too prolix were I to tell all the honors conferred upon him, and all the great nobles and learned men that arrived at his house from the very ends of the earth, to see and converse with him as if he had been an oracle. Many strangers, in fact, came to France for no other purpose than to consult him." The prophecies of Nostradamus consist of upwards of 1,000 stanzas, each of 4 lines, and are to the full as obscure as the oracles of old. They take so great a latitude, both as to time and space, that they are almost sure to be fulfilled somewhere or other in the course of a few centuries. A little ingenuity, like that evinced by Lilly in his explanation about General Monk and the dreadful dead man, might easily make events to fit some of them. Let us try. In his second century, prediction 66, he says, "From great dangers the captive is escaped. A little time, great fortune changed. In the palace the people are caught. By good augury the city is besieged." What is this, a believer might exclaim, but the escape of Napoleon from Elba, his changed fortune, and the occupation of Paris by the Allied armies? Let us try again. In his third century, prediction 98, he says, "Two royal brothers shall make fierce war on each other. So mortal shall be the strife between them that each one shall occupy a fort against the other, for their reign and life shall be the quarrel." Some Lilius Redivivus would find no difficulty in this prediction. To use a vulgar phrase, it is as clear as a pikestaff. Had not the astrologer in view Don Miguel and Don Pedro when he penned this stanza, so much less obscure and oracular than the rest? He is to this day extremely popular in France and the Walloon country of Belgium, where old farmer wives consult him with great confidence and assiduity. Catherine de Médicis was not the only member of her illustrious house who entertained astrologers. At the beginning of the 15th century, there was a man named Basil residing in Florence, who was noted over all Italy for his skill in piercing the darkness of futurity. It is said that he foretold to Cosmo de' Medici, then a private citizen, that he would attain high dignity inasmuch as the ascendant of his nativity was adorned with the same propitious aspects as those of Augustus Caesar and the Emperor Charles V. Another astrologer foretold the death of Prince Alexander de' Medici, and so very minute and particular was he in all the circumstances that he was suspected of being chiefly instrumental in fulfilling his own prophecy, a very common resource with these fellows to keep up their credit. He foretold confidently that the prince should die by the hand of his own familiar friend, a person of a slender habit of body, a small face, a swarthy complexion, and of most remarkable taciturnity. So it afterwards happened, Alexander having been murdered in his chamber by his cousin Lorenzo, who corresponded exactly with the above description. The author of Hermippus Redivivus, in relating this story, inclines to the belief that the astrologer was guiltless of any participation in the crime, but was employed by some friend of Prince Alexander to warn him of his danger. A much more remarkable story is told of an astrologer who lived in Romania in the 15th century, and whose name was Antiochus Tibertus. At that time, nearly all the petty sovereigns of Italy retained such men in their service, and Tibertus, having studied the mathematics with great success at Paris, and delivered many predictions, some of which, for guesses, were not deficient in shrewdness, was taken into the household of Pandolfo di Malatesta, the sovereign of Rimini. His reputation was so great that his study was continually thronged, either with visitors who were persons of distinction, or with clients who came to him for advice. And in a short time he acquired a considerable fortune. Notwithstanding all these advantages, he passed his life miserably and ended it on the scaffold. The following story afterwards got into circulation and has been often triumphantly cited by succeeding astrologers as an irrefragable proof of the truth of their science. It was said that long before he died, he uttered three remarkable prophecies, one relating to himself, another to his friend, and the third to his patron, Pandolfo di Malatesta. The first delivered was that relating to his friend Guido di Bogni, one of the greatest captains of the time. Guido was exceedingly desirous to know his fortune, and so importuned Tibertus that the latter consulted the stars and the lines on his palm to satisfy him. He afterwards told him with a sorrowful face that, according to all the rules of astrology and palmistry, he should be falsely suspected by his best friend, and should lose his life in consequence. Guido then asked the astrologer if he could foretell his own fate, upon which Tibertus again consulted the stars, and found that it was decreed from all eternity that he should end his days on the scaffold. Malatesta, when he heard these predictions, so unlikely to all present appearance to prove true, desired his astrologer to predict his fate also, and to hide nothing from him, however unfavorable it might be. Tiburtus complied and told his patron, at that time one of the most flourishing and powerful princes of Italy, that he should suffer great want and die at last like a beggar in the common hospital of Bologna. And so it happened in all three cases. Guido di Bogni was accused by his own father-in-law, the Count di Bentivoglio, of a treasonable design to deliver up the city of Rimini to the papal forces, and was assassinated afterwards by order of the tyrant Malatesta, as he sat at the supper table, to which he had been invited in all apparent friendship. The astrologer was at the same time thrown into prison, as being concerned in the treason of his friend. He attempted to escape, and had succeeded in letting himself down from his dungeon window into a moat when he was discovered by the sentinels. Thus being reported to Malatesta, he gave orders for his execution on the following morning. Malatesta had at this time no remembrance of the prophecy, and his own fate gave him no uneasiness, but events were silently working its fulfillment. A conspiracy had been formed, though Guido di Bogni was innocent of it, to deliver up Rimini to the Pope, and all the necessary measures having been taken, the city was seized by the Count de Valentinois. In the confusion, Malatesta had barely time to escape from his palace in disguise. He was pursued from place to place by his enemies, abandoned by all his former friends, and finally by his own children. He at last fell ill of a languishing disease at Bologna, and nobody caring to afford him shelter, he was carried to the hospital, where he died. The only thing that detracts from the interest of this remarkable story is the fact that the prophecy was made after the event. For some weeks before the birth of Louis XIV, an astrologer from Germany, who had been sent for by the Marshal de Bassompierre and other noblemen of the court, had taken up his residence in the palace to be ready at a moment's notice to draw the horoscope of the future sovereign of France. When the queen was taken in labor, he was ushered into a contiguous apartment, that he might receive notice of the very instant the child was born. The result of his observations were the three words, Diu, Dure, Feliciter, meaning that the newborn prince should live and reign long, with much labor, and with great glory. No prediction less favorable could have been expected from an astrologer, who had his bread to get, and who was at the same time a courtier. A medal was afterwards struck in commemoration of the event, upon one side of which was figured the nativity of the prince, representing him as driving the chariot of Apollo, with the inscription Ortus Solis Gallici, the rising of the Gallic sun. The best excuse ever made for astrology was that offered by the great astronomer, Kepler, himself an unwilling practicer of the art. He had many applications from his friends to cast nativities for them, and generally gave a positive refusal to such as he was not afraid of offending by his frankness. In other cases, he accommodated himself to the prevailing delusion. In sending a copy of his Ephemerides to Professor Gerlach, he wrote that they were nothing but worthless conjectures, but he was obliged to devote himself to them, or he would have starved. "Ye overwise philosophers," he exclaimed in his Tertius Interveniens, "ye censure this daughter of astronomy beyond her deserts. Know ye not that she must support her mother by her charms? The scanty reward of an astronomer would not provide him with bread if men did not entertain hopes of reading the future in the heavens." Necromancy was, next to astrology, the pretended science most resorted to by those who wished to pry into the future. The earliest instance upon record is that of the witch of Endor and the spirit of Samuel. Nearly all the nations of antiquity believed in the possibility of summoning departed ghosts to disclose the awful secrets that God made clear to the disembodied. Many passages in allusion to this subject will at once suggest themselves to the classical reader, but this art was never carried on openly in any country. All governments looked upon it as a crime of the deepest dye. While astrology was encouraged and its professors courted and rewarded, necromancers were universally condemned to the stake or the gallows. Roger Bacon, Albertus Magnus, Arnold of Villeneuve, and many others were accused by the public opinion of many centuries of meddling in these unhallowed matters. So deep-rooted has always been the popular delusion with respect to accusations of this kind that no crime was ever disproved with such toil and difficulty. That it met great encouragement, nevertheless, is evident from the vast numbers of pretenders to it, who, in spite of the danger, have existed in all ages and countries. Geomancy, or the art of foretelling the future by means of lines and circles and other mathematical figures drawn on the earth, is still extensively practiced in Asiatic countries, but almost unknown in Europe. Augury, from the flight or entrails of birds, so favorite a study among the Romans, is in like manner exploded in Europe. Its most assiduous professors at the present day are the abominable thugs of India. Divination, of which there are many kinds, boasts a more enduring reputation. It has held an empire over the minds of men from the earliest periods of recorded history, and is in all probability coeval with time itself. It was practiced alike by the Jews, the Egyptians, the Chaldeans, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, is equally known to all modern nations in every part of the world, and is not unfamiliar to the untutored tribes that roam in the wilds of Africa and America. Divination, as practiced in civilized Europe at the present day, is chiefly from cards, the teacup, and the lines on the palm of the hand. Gypsies alone make a profession of it, but there are thousands and tens of thousands of humble families in which the good wife, and even the good man, resort to the grounds at the bottom of their teacups to know whether the next harvest will be abundant, or their sow bring forth a numerous litter, and in which the young maidens look to the same place to know when they are to be married, and whether the man of their choice is to be dark or fair, rich or poor, kind or cruel. Divination by cards, so great a favorite among the moderns, is, of course, a modern science, as cards do not yet boast an antiquity of much more than 400 years. Divination by the palm, so confidently believed in by half the village lasses in Europe, is of older date and seems to have been known to the Egyptians in the time of the patriarchs, as well as divination by the cup, which, as we are informed in Genesis, was practiced by Joseph. Divination by the rod was also practiced by the Egyptians. In comparatively recent times, it was pretended that by this means hidden treasures could be discovered. It now appears to be altogether exploded in Europe. Onomancy, or the foretelling of a man's fate by the letters of his name and the various transpositions of which they are capable, is a more modern sort of divination, but it reckons comparatively few believers. The following list of the various species of divination formerly in use is given by Gall in his Megastromancer and quoted in Hone's Yearbook, page 1517. Stereomancy, or divining by the elements. Aeromancy, or divining by the air. Pyromancy, by fire. Hydromancy, by water. Geomancy, by earth. Theomancy, pretending to divine by the revelation of the Spirit and by the Scriptures or Word of God. Demonomancy, by the aid of devils and evil spirits. Idolomancy, by idols, images, and figures. Psychomancy, by the soul affections or dispositions of men. Anthropomancy, by the entrails of human beings. Theriomancy, by beasts. Ornithomancy, by birds. Ichthyomancy, by fishes. Botanomancy, by herbs. Lithomancy, by stones. Claromancy, by lots. Oniromancy, by dreams. Onomancy, by names. Arithmancy, by numbers. Logarithmancy, by logarithms. Sternomancy, by the marks from the breast to the belly. Gastromancy, by the sound of or marks upon the belly. Omphalomancy, by the navel. Chiromancy, by the hands. Podomancy, by the feet. Onchiomancy, by the nails. Cephalionomancy, by ass's heads. Tephromancy, by ashes. Capnomancy, by smoke. Nisomancy, by the burning of incense. Ceromancy, by the melting of wax. Lacanomancy, by basins of water. Catoptromancy, by looking glasses. Cartomancy, by writing in papers and by valentines. Macaromancy, by knives and swords. Crystallomancy, by crystals. Dactylomancy, by rings. Kiskanomancy, by sieves. Axonomancy, by saws. Calmmancy, by vessels of brass or other metal. Spatillomancy, by skins, bones, etc. Astromancy, by stars. Psiomancy, by shadows. Astragalomancy, by dice. Oinomancy, by the lees of wine. Sycomancy, by figs. Tyromancy, by cheese. Alphitomancy, by meal, flour, or bran. Crithomancy, by corn or grain. Electromancy, by cocks. Gyromancy, by circles. Lampadomancy, by candles and lamps. Oneirocriticism, or the art of interpreting dreams, is a relic of the most remote ages, which has subsisted through all the changes that moral or physical revolutions have operated in the world. The records of 5,000 years bear abundant testimony to the universal diffusion of the belief that the skillful could read the future in dreams. The rules of the art, if any existed in ancient times, are not known, but in our day one simple rule opens the whole secret. Dreams, say all the wiseacres in Christendom, are to be interpreted by contraries. Thus, if you dream of filth, you will acquire something valuable. If you dream of the dead, you will hear news of the living. If you dream of gold and silver, you run a risk of being without either. And if you dream you have many friends, you will be persecuted by many enemies. The rule, however, does not hold good in all cases. It is fortunate to dream of little pigs, but unfortunate to dream of big bullocks. If you dream you have lost a tooth, you may be sure that you will shortly lose a friend, and if you dream that your house is on fire, you will receive news from a far country. If you dream of vermin, it is a sign that there will be sickness in your family, and if you dream of serpents, you will have friends who, in the course of time, will prove your bitterest enemies. But of all dreams, it is most fortunate if you dream that you are wallowing up to your neck in mud and mire. Clear water is a sign of grief, and great troubles, distress, and perplexity are predicted if you dream that you stand naked in the public streets and know not where to find a garment to shield you from the gaze of the multitude. In many parts of Great Britain and the continents of Europe and America, there are to be found elderly women in the villages and country places whose interpretations of dreams are looked upon with as much reverence as if they were oracles. In districts remote from towns, it is not uncommon to find the members of a family regularly every morning narrating their dreams at the breakfast table, and becoming happy or miserable for the day according to their interpretation. There is not a flower that blossoms or fruit that ripens that, dreamed of, is not ominous of either good or evil to such people. Every tree of the field or the forest is endowed with a similar influence over the fate of mortals, if seen in the night visions. To dream of the ash is the sign of a long journey, and of an oak prognosticates long life and prosperity. To dream you stripped the bark off any tree is a sign to a maiden of an approaching loss of a character. To a married woman, of a family bereavement, and to a man, of an accession of fortune. To dream of a leafless tree is a sign of great sorrow, and of a branchless trunk a sign of despair and suicide. The elder tree is more auspicious to the sleeper, while the fir tree, better still, betokens all manner of comfort and prosperity. The lime tree predicts a voyage across the ocean, while the yew and the alder are ominous of sickness to the young and of death to the old. Among the flowers and fruits charged with messages for the future, the following is a list of the most important, arranged from approved sources in alphabetical order. Asparagus, gathered and tied up in bundles, is an omen of tears. If you see it growing in your dreams, it is a sign of good fortune. Aloes, without a flower, betokens long life. In flower, betokens a legacy. Artichokes. This vegetable is a sign that you will receive in a short time a favor from the hands of those from whom you would least expect it. Agrimony. This herb denotes that there will be sickness in your house. Anemone predicts love. Auriculas, in beds, denote luck, in pots, marriage, while to gather them foretells widowhood. Bilberries predict a pleasant excursion. Broomflowers, an increase of family. Cauliflowers predict that all your friends will slight you, or that you will fall into poverty and find no one to pity you. Dock leaves, a present from the country. Daffodils, any maiden who dreams of daffodils is warned by her good angel to avoid going into a wood with her lover, or into any dark or retired place where she might not be able to make people hear her if she cried out. Alas for her if she pay no attention to the warning. Never again shall she put garland on. Instead of it she'll wear sad cypress now, and bitter elder broken from the bough. Figs, if green, betoken embarrassment. If dried, money to the poor and mirth to the rich. Heart's ease betokes heart's pain. Lilies predict joy. Water lilies, danger from the sea. Lemons betoken a separation. Pomegranates predict happy wedlock to those who are single and reconciliation to those who are married and have disagreed. Quinces prognosticate pleasant company. Roses denote happy love, not unmixed with sorrow from other sources. Sorrel, to dream of this herb is a sign that you will shortly have occasion to exert all your prudence to overcome some great calamity. Sunflowers show that your pride will be deeply wounded. Violets predict evil to the single and joy to the married. Yellow flowers of any kind predict jealousy. Yewberries predict loss of character to both sexes. It is quite astonishing to see the great demand there is, both in England and France, for dream books and other trash of the same kind. Two books in England enjoy an extraordinary popularity and have run through upwards of 50 editions in as many years in London alone, besides being reprinted in Manchester, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and Dublin. One is Mother Bridget's Dream Book and Oracle of Fate. The other is The Norwood Gypsy. It is stated on the authority of one who is curious in these matters that there is a demand for these works, which are sold at sums varying from a penny to sixpence, chiefly to servant girls and imperfectly educated people all over the country, of upwards of 11,000 annually, and that at no period during the last 30 years has the average number sold been less than this. The total number during this period would thus amount to 330,000. It should be observed that the rules for the interpretation of dreams are far from being universal. The cheeks of the peasant girl of England glow with pleasure in the morning after she has dreamed of a rose, while the paysan of Normandy dreads disappointment and vexation for the very same reason. The Switzer who dreams of an oak tree does not share in the Englishman's joy, for he imagines that the vision is a warning to him that, from some trifling cause, an overwhelming calamity will burst over him. Thus do the ignorant and the credulous torment themselves. Thus do they spread their nets to catch vexation, and pass their lives between hopes which are of no value and fears which are a positive evil. Omens. Among the other means of self-annoyance upon which men have stumbled in their vain hope of discovering the future, signs and omens hold a conspicuous place. There is scarcely an occurrence in nature which, happening at a certain time, is not looked upon by some persons as a prognosticator either of good or evil. The latter are in the greatest number, so much more ingenious are we in tormenting ourselves than in discovering reasons for enjoyment in the things that surround us. We go out of our course to make ourselves uncomfortable. The cup of life is not bitter enough to our palate, and we distill superfluous poison to put into it, or conjure up hideous things to frighten ourselves at, which would never exist if we did not make them. We suffer, says Addison, as much from trifling accidents as from real evils. I have known the shooting of a star spoil a night's rest, and have seen a man in love grow pale and lose his appetite upon the plucking of a merry thought. A screech owl at midnight has alarmed a family more than a band of robbers. Nay, the voice of a cricket has struck more terror than the roaring of a lion. There is nothing so inconsiderable which may not appear dreadful to an imagination that is filled with omens and prognostics. A rusty nail or a crooked pin shoot up into prodigies. The century and a quarter that has passed away since Addison wrote has seen the fall of many errors. Many fallacies and delusions have been crushed under the foot of time since then. But this has been left unscathed, to frighten the weak-minded and embitter their existence. A belief in omens is not confined to the humble and uninformed. A general who led an army with credit has been known to feel alarmed at a winding sheet in the candle. And learned men who had honorably and fairly earned the highest honors of literature have been seen to gather their little ones around them and fear that one would be snatched away because, when stole upon the time the dead of night and heavy sleep had closed up mortal eyes, a dog in the street was howling at the moon. Persons who would acknowledge freely that the belief in omens was unworthy of a man of sense have yet confessed at the same time that, in spite of their reason, they have been unable to conquer their fears of death when they hear the harmless insect called the death watch ticking in the wall, or saw an oblong hollow coal fly out of the fire. Many other evil omens, besides those mentioned above, alarm the vulgar and the weak. If a sudden shivering comes over such people, they believe that at that instant an enemy is treading over the spot that will one day be their grave. If they meet a sow when they first walk abroad in the morning, it is an omen of evil for that day. To meet an ass is in like manner unlucky. It is also very unfortunate to walk under a ladder, to forget to eat goose on the festival of St. Michael, to tread upon a beetle, or to eat the twin nuts that are sometimes found in one shell. Woe in like manner is predicted to that wight who inadvertently upsets the salt. Each grain that is overthrown will bring to him a day of sorrow. If 13 persons sit at a table, one of them will die within the year, and all of them will be unhappy. Of all evil omens, this is the worst. The facetious Dr. Kitchener used to observe that there was one case in which he believed that it was really unlucky for 13 persons to sit down to dinner. And that was when there was only dinner enough for 12. Unfortunately for their peace of mind, the great majority of people do not take this wise view of the matter. In almost every country of Europe, the same superstition prevails, and some carry it so far as to look upon the number 13 as in every way ominous of evil. And if they find 13 coins in their purse, cast away the odd one like a polluted thing. The philosophic Béranger, in his exquisite song, 13 at Table, has taken a poetical view of this humiliating superstition, and mingled, as is his wont, a lesson of genuine wisdom in his lay. Being at dinner, he overthrows the salt, and, looking round the room, discovers that he is the 13th guest. While he is mourning his unhappy fate and conjuring up visions of disease and suffering in the grave, he is suddenly startled by the apparition of death herself. Not in the shape of a grim foe with skeleton ribs and menacing dart, but of an angel of light who shows the folly of tormenting ourselves with the dread of her approach, when she is the friend rather than the enemy of man, and frees us from the fetters which bind us to the dust. If men could bring themselves to look upon death in this manner, living well and wisely till her inevitable approach, how vast a store of grief and vexation would they spare themselves! Among good omens, one of the most conspicuous is to meet a piebald horse. To meet two of these animals is still more fortunate, and if on such an occasion you spit thrice and form any reasonable wish, it will be gratified within 3 days. It is also a sign of good fortune if you inadvertently put on your stocking wrong side out. If you willfully wear your stocking in this fashion, no good will come of it. It is very lucky to sneeze twice, but if you sneeze a third time, the omen loses its power, and your good fortune will be nipped in the bud. If a strange dog follow you and fawn on you and wish to attach itself to you, it is a sign of very great prosperity. Just as fortunate is it if a strange male cat comes to your house and manifests friendly intentions towards your family. If a she-cat, it is an omen, on the contrary, of very great misfortune. If a swarm of bees alight in your garden, some very high honor and great joys await you. Besides these glimpses of the future, you may know something of your fate by a diligent attention to every itching that you may feel in your body. Thus, if the eye or the nose itches, it is a sign you will be shortly vexed. If the foot itches, you will tread upon strange ground. And if the elbow itches, you will change your bedfellow. Itching of the right hand prognosticates that you will soon have a sum of money, and of the left, that you will be called upon to disburse it. These are but a few of the omens which are generally credited in modern Europe. A complete list of them would fatigue from its length and sicken from its absurdity. It would be still more unprofitable to attempt to specify the various delusions of the same kind which are believed among Oriental nations. Every reader will remember the comprehensive formula of cursing preserved in Tristram Shandy. Curse a man after any fashion you remember or can invent, you will be sure to find it there. The Oriental creed of omens is not less comprehensive. Every movement of the body, every emotion of the mind, is at certain times an omen. Every form and object in nature, even the shape of the clouds and the changes of the weather. Every color, every sound, whether of men or animals, or birds or insects or inanimate things, is an omen. Nothing is too trifling or inconsiderable to inspire a hope which is not worth cherishing, or a fear which is sufficient to embitter existence. From the belief in omens springs the superstition that has, from very early ages, set apart certain days as more favorable than others for prying into the secrets of futurity. The following, copied verbatim from the popular Dream and Omen book of Mother Bridget, will show the belief of the people of England at the present day. Those who are curious as to the ancient history of these observances will find abundant aliment in the Everyday Book. The 1st of January. If a young maiden drink, on going to bed, a pint of cold spring water, in which is beat up an amulet, composed of the yolk of a pullet's egg, the legs of a spider, and the skin of an eel pounded, her future destiny will be revealed to her in a dream. This charm fails of its effect if tried any other day of the year. Valentine Day. Let a single woman go out of her own door very early in the morning, and if the first person she meets be a woman, she will not be married that year. If she meet a man, she will be married within 3 months. Lady Day. The following charm may be tried this day with certain success. String 31 nuts on a string, composed of red worsted mixed with blue silk, and tie it round your neck on going to bed, repeating these lines, oh, I wish to see who my true love is to be. Shortly after midnight, you will see your lover in a dream, and be informed at the same time of all the principal events of your future life. St. Swithin's Eve. Select 3 things you most wish to know. Write them down with a new pen and red ink on a sheet of fine wove paper, from which you must previously cut off all the corners and burn them. Fold the paper into a true lover's knot and wrap round it 3 hairs from your head. Place the paper under your pillow for 3 successive nights, and your curiosity to know the future will be satisfied. St. Mark's Eve. Repair to the nearest churchyard as the clock strikes 12, and take from a grave on the south side of the church 3 tufts of grass, the longer and ranker the better. And on going to bed, place them under your pillow, repeating earnestly 3 several times, the eve of St. Mark by prediction is blessed. Set therefore my hopes and my fears all to rest. Let me know my fate, whether weal or woe, whether my ranks to be high or low, whether to live single or be a bride, and the destiny my star doth provide. Should you have no dream that night, you will be single and miserable all your life. If you dream of thunder and lightning, your life will be one of great difficulty and sorrow. Candlemas Eve. On this night, which is the purification of the Virgin Mary, let 3, 5, 7, or 9 young maidens assemble together in a square chamber. Hang in each corner a bundle of sweet herbs mixed with rue and rosemary. Then mix a cake of flour, olive oil, and white sugar, every maiden having an equal share in the making and the expense of it. Afterwards, it must be cut into equal pieces, each one marking the piece as she cuts it with the initials of her name. It is then to be baked 1 hour before the fire, not a word being spoken the whole time, and the maidens sitting with their arms and knees across. Each piece of cake is then to be wrapped up in a sheet of paper, on which each maiden shall write the love part of Solomon's songs. If she put this under her pillow, she will dream true. She will see her future husband and every one of her children, and will know besides whether her family will be poor or prosperous, a comfort to her or the contrary. Midsummer. Take 3 roses, smoke them with sulphur, and exactly at 3 in the day, Bury one of the roses under a yew tree, the second in a newly made grave, and put the third under your pillow for 3 nights, and at the end of that period burn it in a fire of charcoal. Your dreams during that time will be prophetic of your future destiny, and what is still more curious and valuable, says Mother Bridget, the man whom you are to wed will enjoy no peace till he comes and visits you. Besides this, you will perpetually haunt his dreams. St. John's Eve. Make a new pincushion of the very best black velvet. No inferior quality will answer the purpose. And on one side stick your name at full length with the very smallest pins that can be bought. None other will do. On the other side make a cross with some very large pins and surround it with a circle. Put this into your stocking when you take it off at night and hang it up at the foot of the bed. All your future life will pass before you in a dream. First new moon of the year. On the first new moon in the year, take a pint of clear spring water and infuse into it the white of an egg laid by a white hen, a glass of white wine, 3 almonds peeled white, and a tablespoonful of white rose water. Drink this on going to bed, not making more nor less than 3 draughts of it, repeating the following verses 3 several times in a clear, distinct voice, but not so loud as to be overheard by anybody. If I dream of water pure before the coming morn, 'tis a sign I shall be poor, and unto wealth not born. If I dream of tasting beer, middling then will be my cheer, checkered with the good and bad, sometimes joyful, sometimes sad. But should I dream of drinking wine, wealth and pleasure will be mine. The stronger the drink, the better the cheer. Dreams of my destiny appear, appear. 29th of February. This day, though it only occurs once in 4 years, is peculiarly auspicious to those who desire to have a glance at futurity, especially to young maidens, burning with anxiety to know the appearance and complexion of their future lords. The charm to be adopted is the following. Stick 27 of the smallest pins that are made, 3 by 3, into a tallow candle. Light it up at the wrong end, and then place it in a candlestick made out of clay, which must be drawn from a virgin's grave. Place this on the chimney place in the left-hand corner, exactly as the clock strikes 12, and go to bed immediately. When the candle is burnt out, take the pins and put them into your left shoe, and before 9 nights have elapsed, your fate will be revealed to you. We have now taken a hasty review of the various modes of seeking to discover the future, especially as practiced in modern times. The main features of the folly appear essentially the same in all countries. National character and peculiarities operate some difference of interpretation. The mountaineer makes the natural phenomena which he most frequently witnesses prognosticative of the future. The dweller in the plains, in a similar manner, seeks to know his fate among the signs of the things that surround him, and tints his superstition with the hues of his own clime. The same spirit animates them all, the same desire to know that which infinite mercy has concealed. There is but little probability that the curiosity of mankind in this respect will ever be wholly eradicated. Death and ill fortune are continual bugbears to the weak-minded, the irreligious, and the ignorant. And while such exist in the world, divines will preach upon its impiety, and philosophers discourse upon its absurdity in vain. Still, it is evident that these follies have greatly diminished. Soothsayers and prophets have lost the credit they formerly enjoyed, and skulk in secret now where they once showed their faces in the blaze of day. So far, there is manifest improvement. The Magnetizers. Some deemed them wondrous wise, and some believed them mad. Beattie's Minstrel. The wonderful influence of imagination in the cure of diseases is well known. A motion of the hand or a glance of the eye will throw a weak and credulous patient into a fit, and a pill made of bread, if taken with sufficient faith, will operate a cure better than all the drugs in the pharmacopoeia. The Prince of Orange at the Siege of Breda in 1625 cured all his soldiers who were dying of the scurvy by a philanthropic piece of quackery which he played upon them with the knowledge of the physicians when all other means had failed. Many hundreds of instances of a similar kind might be related, especially from the history of witchcraft. The mummeries, strange gesticulations, and barbarous jargon of witches and sorcerers, which frightened credulous and nervous women, brought on all those symptoms of hysteria and other similar diseases, so well understood now, but which were then supposed to be the work of the devil, not only by the victims and the public in general, but by the operators themselves. See Vandermeij's account of the Siege of Breda. The garrison, being afflicted with scurvy, the Prince of Orange sent the physicians 2 or 3 small phials, containing a decoction of chamomile, wormwood, and camphor, telling them to pretend that it was a medicine of the greatest value and extremest rarity, which had been procured with very much danger and difficulty from the East, and so strong that 2 or 3 drops would impart a healing virtue to a gallon of water. The soldiers had faith in their commander. They took the medicine with cheerful faces, and grew well rapidly. They afterwards thronged about the prince in groups of 20 and 30 at a time, praising his skill and loading him with protestations of gratitude. In the age when alchemy began to fall into some disrepute and learning to lift up its voice against it, a new delusion based upon this power of imagination suddenly arose and found apostles among all the alchemists. Numbers of them, forsaking their old pursuits, made themselves magnetizers. It appeared first in the shape of mineral and afterwards of animal magnetism, under which latter name it survives to this day and numbers its dupes by thousands. The mineral magnetizers claim the first notice as the worthy predecessors of the quacks of the present day. The honor claimed for Paracelsus of being the first of the Rosicrucians has been disputed, but his claim to be considered the first of the magnetizers can scarcely be challenged. It has been already mentioned of him in the part of this work which treats of alchemy that, like nearly all the distinguished adepts, he was a physician, and pretended not only to make gold and confer immortality, but to cure all diseases. He was the first who, with the latter view, attributed occult and miraculous powers to the magnet. Animated apparently by a sincere conviction that the magnet was the philosopher's stone, which, if it could not transmute metals, could soothe all human suffering and arrest the progress of decay, he traveled for many years in Persia and Arabia in search of the mountain of adamant, so famed in Oriental fables. When he practiced as a physician at Basel, he called one of his nostrums by the name of Azoth, a stone or crystal which, he said, contained magnetic properties and cured epilepsy, hysteria, and spasmodic affections. He soon found imitators. His fame spread far and near, and thus were sown the first seeds of that error which has since taken root and flourished so widely. In spite of the denial of modern practitioners, this must be considered the origin of magnetism, for we find that, beginning with Paracelsus, there was a regular succession of mineral magnetizers until Mesmer appeared and gave a new feature to the delusion. Paracelsus boasted of being able to transplant diseases from the human frame into the earth by means of the magnet. He said there were 6 ways by which this might be effected. One of them would be quite sufficient as a specimen. If a person suffer from disease, either local or general, let the following remedy be tried. Take a magnet impregnated with mummy and mixed with rich earth. In this earth sow some seeds that have a congruity or homogeneity with the disease. Then let this earth, well sifted and mixed with mummy, be laid in an earthen vessel, and let the seeds committed to it be watered daily with a lotion in which the diseased limb or body has been washed. Thus will the disease be transplanted from the human body to the seeds which are in the earth. Having done this, transplant the seeds from the earthen vessel to the ground, and wait till they begin to sprout into herbs. As they increase, the disease will diminish, and when they have arrived at their full growth, it will disappear altogether. Mummies were of several kinds, and were all of great use in magnetic medicines. Paracelsus enumerates 6 kinds of mummies, the first 4 only differing in the composition used by different people for preserving their dead, are the Egyptian, Arabian, Pisisfaltos, and Libyan. The 5th mummy of peculiar power was made from criminals that had been hanged. For from such there is a general secation that expungeth the watery humor without destroying the oil and spiritual, which is cherished by the heavenly luminaries and strengthened continually by the affluence and impulses of the celestial spirits, whence it may be properly called by the name of constellated or celestial mummy. The sixth kind of mummy was made of corpuscles or spiritual effluences radiated from the living body. Though we cannot get very clear ideas on this head or respecting the manner in which they were caught. Medicina diatastica, or sympathetical mummy, abstracted from the works of Paracelsus, and translated out of the Latin by Fernando Parkhurst, Gentleman of London, 1653, pages 2 and 7, quoted by the Foreign Quarterly Review, volume 12, page 415. Kircher, the Jesuit, whose quarrel with the alchemists was the means of exposing many of their impostures, was a firm believer in the efficacy of the magnet. Having been applied to by a patient afflicted with hernia, he directed the man to swallow a small magnet reduced to powder, while he applied at the same time to the external swelling a poultice made of filings of iron. He expected that by this means the magnet, when it got to the corresponding place inside, would draw in the iron and with it the tumor, which would thus, he said, be safely and expeditiously reduced. As this new doctrine of magnetism spread, it was found that wounds inflicted with any metallic substance could be cured by the magnet. In process of time, the delusion so increased that it was deemed sufficient to magnetize a sword to cure any hurt which that sword might have inflicted. This was the origin of the celebrated weapon salve, which excited so much attention about the middle of the 17th century. The following was the recipe given by Paracelsus for the cure of any wounds inflicted by a sharp weapon, except such as had penetrated the heart, the brain, or the arteries. Take of moss growing on the head of a thief who has been hanged and left in the air, of real mummy, of human blood, still warm, of each 1 ounce, of human suet, 2 ounces, of linseed oil, turpentine, and Armenian bole, of each 2 drams. Mix all well in a mortar and keep the salve in an oblong narrow urn. With this salve, the weapon, after being dipped in the blood from the wound, was to be carefully anointed and then laid by in a cool place. In the meantime, the wound was to be duly washed with fair clean water, covered with a clean soft linen rag, and opened once a day to cleanse off purulent or other matter. Of the success of this treatment, says the writer of the able article on animal magnetism in the 12th volume of the Foreign Quarterly Review, there cannot be the least doubt. For surgeons at this moment follow exactly the same method, except anointing the weapon. The weapon salve continued to be much spoken of on the continent, and many eager claimants appeared for the honor of the invention. Dr. Flood, or A. Fluctibus, the Rosicrucian, who has been already mentioned in a previous part of this volume, was very zealous in introducing it into England. He tried it with great success in several cases, and no wonder, for while he kept up the spirits of his patients by boasting of the great efficacy of the salve, he never neglected those common but much more important remedies of washing, bandaging, etc., which the experience of all ages had declared sufficient for the purpose. Flood, moreover, declared that the magnet was a remedy for all diseases, if properly applied, but that man having, like the earth, a north and a south pole, magnetism could only take place when his body was in a boreal position. In the midst of his popularity, an attack was made upon him and his favorite remedy, the salve, which, however, did little or nothing to diminish the belief in its efficacy. One Parson Foster wrote a pamphlet entitled Hyplocrisma Spongus, or A Sponge to Wipe Away the Weapon Salve, in which he declared that it was as bad as witchcraft to use or recommend such an unguent, that it was invented by the devil, who at the last day would seize upon every person who had given it the slightest encouragement. In fact, said Parson Foster, the devil himself gave it to Paracelsus, Paracelsus to the emperor to the courtier to Baptista Porta, and Baptista Porta to Dr. Flood, a doctor of physic yet living and practicing in the famous city of London, who now stands tooth and nail for it. Dr. Flood, thus assailed, took up the pen in defense of his unguent in a reply called The Squeezing of Parson Foster's Sponge, wherein the sponge-bearer's immodest carriage and behavior towards his brethren is detected. The bitter flames of his slanderous reports are, by the sharp vinegar of truth, corrected and quite extinguished, and lastly, the virtuous validity of his sponge in wiping away the weapon salve is crushed out and clean abolished. Shortly after this dispute, a more distinguished believer in the weapon salve made his appearance in the person of Sir Kenelm Digby, the son of Sir Everard Digby, who was executed for his participation in the gunpowder plot. This gentleman, who in other respects was an accomplished scholar and an able man, was imbued with all the extravagant notions of the alchemists. He believed in the philosopher's stone and wished to engage Descartes to devote his energies to the discovery of the elixir of life, or some other means by which the existence of man might be prolonged to an indefinite period. He gave his wife, the beautiful Venetia Anastasia Stanley, a dish of capons fed upon vipers, according to the plan supposed to have been laid down by Arnold de Villeneuve, in the hope that she might thereby preserve her loveliness for a century. If such a man once took up the idea of the weapon salve, it was to be expected that he would make the most of it. In his hands, however, it was changed from an unguent into a powder, and was called the Powder of Sympathy. He pretended that he had acquired the knowledge of it from a Carmelite friar, who had learned it in Persia or Armenia from an Oriental philosopher of great renown. King James, the Prince of Wales, the Duke of Buckingham, and many other noble personages believed in its efficacy. The following remarkable instance of his mode of cure was read by Sir Kenelm to a society of learned men at Montpelier. Mr. James Howell, the well-known author of the Dendrologia, and of various letters, coming by chance as two of his best friends were fighting a duel, rushed between them and endeavored to part them. He seized the sword of one of the combatants by the hilt, while at the same time he grasped the other by the blade. Being transported with fury one against the other, they struggled to rid themselves of the hindrance caused by their friend. And in so doing, the one whose sword was held by the blade by Mr. Howell drew it away roughly and nearly cut his hand off, severing the nerves and muscles and penetrating to the bone. The other, almost at the same instant, disengaged his sword and aimed a blow at the head of his antagonist, which Mr. Howell, observing, raised his wounded hand with the rapidity of thought to prevent the blow. The sword fell on the back of his already wounded hand and cut it severely. "It seemed," said Sir Kenelm Digby, "as if some unlucky star raged over them that they should have both shed the blood of that dear friend for whose life they would have given their own if they had been in their proper mind at the time." Seeing Mr. Howell's face all besmeared with blood from his wounded hand, they both threw down their swords and embraced him, and bound up his hand with a garter to close the veins which were cut and bled profusely. They then conveyed him home and sent for a surgeon. King James, who was much attached to Mr. Howell, afterwards sent his own surgeon to attend him. We must continue the narrative in the words of Sir Kenelm Digby. "It was my chance," says he, "to be lodged hard by him, and 4 or 5 days after, as I was making myself ready, he came to my house and prayed me to view his wounds. 'For I understand," said he, "that you have extraordinary remedies on such occasions, and my surgeons apprehend some fear that it may grow to a gangrene, and so the hand must be cut off." In effect, his countenance discovered that he was in much pain, which, he said, was insupportable in regard of the extreme inflammation. "I told him I would willingly serve him, but if, haply, he knew the manner how I could cure him, without touching or seeing him, it might be that he would not expose himself to my manner of curing, because he would think it, peradventure, either ineffectual or superstitious." He replied, "The many wonderful things which people have related unto me of your way of medicinement makes me nothing doubt at all of its efficacy, and all that I have to say unto you is comprehended in the Spanish proverb, 'Hágase el milagro y hágalo Mahoma,' let the miracle be done, though Mahomet do it." I asked him then for anything that had the blood upon it. So he presently sent for his garter, wherewith his hand was first bound. And as I called for a basin of water, as if I would wash my hands, I took a handful of powder of vitriol, which I had in my study, and presently dissolved it. As soon as the bloody garter was brought me, I put it in the basin, observing in the interim what Mr. Howell did, who stood talking with a gentleman in a corner of my chamber, not regarding at all what I was doing. He started suddenly, as if he had found some strange alteration in himself. I asked him what he ailed. I know not what ails me, but I find that I feel no more pain. Methinks that a pleasing kind of freshness, as it were a wet cold napkin, did spread over my hand, which hath taken away the inflammation that tormented me before. I replied, Since then you feel already so much good of my medicament, I advise you to cast away all your plasters. Only keep the wound clean and in a moderate temper betwixt heat and cold. This was presently reported to the Duke of Buckingham and a little after to the King, who were both very curious to know the circumstances of the business, which was that after dinner I took the garter out of the water and put it to dry before a great fire. It was scarce dry before Mr. Howell's servant came running and saying that his master felt as much burning as ever he had done, if not more, for the heat was such as if his hand were betwixt coals of fire. I answered that although that had happened at present, yet he should find ease in a short time, for I knew the reason of this new accident, and would provide accordingly. For his master should be free from that inflammation, it might be before he could possibly return to him. But in case he found no ease, I wished him to come presently back again. If not, he might forbear coming. Thereupon he went, and at the instant I did put the garter again into the water. Thereupon he found his master without any pain at all. To be brief, there was no sense of pain afterwards, but within 5 or 6 days the wounds were cicatrized and entirely healed. Such is the marvelous story of Sir Kenelm Digby. Other practitioners of that age were not behind him in their pretensions. It was not always thought necessary to use either the powder of sympathy or the weapon salve to effect a cure. It was sufficient to magnetize the sword with the hand, the first faint dawn of the animal theory, to relieve any pain the same weapon had caused. They asserted that if they stroked the sword upwards with their fingers, the wounded person would feel immediate relief, but if they stroked it downwards, he would feel intolerable pain. Another very singular notion of the power and capabilities of magnetism was entertained at the same time. It was believed that a sympathetic alphabet could be made on the flesh, by means of which persons could correspond with each other and communicate all their ideas with the rapidity of volition, although thousands of miles apart. From the arms of two persons a piece of flesh was cut and mutually transplanted while still warm and bleeding. The piece so severed grew to the new arm on which it was placed, but still retained so close a sympathy with its native limb that its old possessor was always sensible of any injury done to it. Upon these transplanted pieces were tattooed the letters of the alphabet, so that when a communication was to be made, either of the persons, though the wide Atlantic rolled between them, had only to prick his arm with a magnetic needle, and straightway his friend received intimation that the telegraph was at work. Whatever letter he pricked on his own arm pained the same letter on the arm of his correspondent. Contemporary with Sir Kenelm Digby was the no less famous Mr. Valentine Greatraks, who, without mentioning magnetism or laying claim to any theory, practiced upon himself and others a deception much more akin to the animal magnetism of the present day than the mineral magnetism it was then so much the fashion to study. He was the son of an Irish gentleman of good education and property in the county of Cork. He fell at an early age into a sort of melancholy derangement. After some time he had an impulse or strange persuasion in his mind, which continued to present itself, whether he were sleeping or waking, that God had given him the power of curing the king's evil. He mentioned this persuasion to his wife, who very candidly told him that he was a fool. He was not quite sure of this, notwithstanding the high authority from which it came, and determined to make trial of the power that was in him. A few days afterwards he went to one William Marr, of Saltersbridge in the parish of Lismore, who was grievously afflicted with the king's evil in his eyes, cheek, and throat. Upon this man, who was of abundant faith, he laid his hands, stroked him, and prayed fervently. He had the satisfaction to see him heal considerably in the course of a few days, and finally, with the aid of other remedies, to be quite cured. This success encouraged him in the belief that he had a divine mission. Day after day he had further impulses from on high that he was called upon to cure the ague also. In the course of time he extended his powers to the curing of epilepsy, ulcers, aches, and lameness. All the county of Cork was in a commotion to see this extraordinary physician, who certainly operated some very great benefit in cases where the disease was heightened by hypochondria and depression of spirits. According to his own account, such great multitudes resorted to him from divers places that he had no time to follow his own business or enjoy the company of his family and friends. He was obliged to set aside 3 days in the week from 6 in the morning till 6 at night, during which time only he laid hands upon all that came. Still, the crowds which thronged around him were so great that the neighboring towns were not able to accommodate them. He thereupon left his house in the country and went to Youghal, where the resort of sick people, not only from all parts of Ireland but from England, continued so great that the magistrates were afraid they would infect the place by their diseases. Several of these poor credulous people no sooner saw him than they fell into fits, and he restored them by waving his hand in their faces and praying over them. Nay, he affirmed that the touch of his glove had driven pains away, and on one occasion cast out from a woman several devils or evil spirits, who tormented her day and night. "Every one of these devils," says Greatrax, "was like to choke her when it came up into her throat." It was evident from this that the woman's complaint was nothing but hysteria. The clergy of the diocese of Lismore, who seemed to have had much clearer notions of Greatrax's pretensions than their parishioners, set their faces against the new prophet and worker of miracles. He was cited to appear in the dean's court, and prohibited from laying on his hands for the future. But he cared nothing for the church. He imagined that he derived his powers direct from heaven, and continued to throw people into fits and bring them to their senses again, as usual, almost exactly after the fashion of modern magnetizers. His reputation became at last so great that Lord Conway sent to him from London, begging that he would come over immediately to cure a grievous headache, which his lady had suffered for several years, and which the principal physicians of England had been unable to relieve. Greatrax accepted the invitation and tried his manipulations and prayers upon Lady Conway. He failed, however, in affording any relief. The poor lady's headache was excited by causes too serious to allow her any help, even from faith and a lively imagination. He lived for some months in Lord Conway's house at Ragley in Warwickshire, operating cures similar to those he had performed in Ireland. He afterwards removed to London and took a house in Lincoln's Inn Fields, which soon became the daily resort of all the nervous and credulous women of the metropolis. A very amusing account of Greatrax at this time, 1665, is given in the second volume of the Miscellanies of Saint Evremond, under the title of The Irish Prophet. It is the most graphic sketch ever made of this early magnetizer. Whether his pretensions were more or less absurd than those of some of his successors, who have lately made their appearance among us, would be hard to say. "When Monsieur de Comminges," says Saint Evremond, "was ambassador from his most Christian majesty to the King of Great Britain, there came to London an Irish prophet who passed himself off as a great worker of miracles. Some persons of quality having begged Monsieur de Comminges to invite him to his house, that they might be witnesses of some of his miracles, the ambassador promised to satisfy them, as much to gratify his own curiosity as from courtesy to his friends, and gave notice to Greatrax that he would be glad to see him. A rumor of the prophet's coming soon spread all over the town, and the hotel of Monsieur de Comminges was crowded by sick persons, who came full of confidence in their speedy cure. The Irishman made them wait a considerable time for him, but came at last, in the midst of their impatience, with a grave and simple countenance that showed no signs of his being a cheat. Monsieur de Comminges prepared to question him strictly, hoping to discourse with him on the matters that he had read of in Van Helmont and Bodinus. But he was not able to do so, much to his regret, for the crowd became so great, and cripples and others pressed around so impatiently to be the first cured, that the servants were obliged to use threats and even force before they could establish order among them or place them in proper ranks. The prophet affirmed that all diseases were caused by evil spirits. Every infirmity was with him a case of diabolical possession. The first that was presented to him was a man suffering from gout and rheumatism, and so severely that the physicians had been